In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
In 1970, Milton Friedman published his essay, "The Social Responsibility of a Business is to Increase Its Profits." That's it. The purpose of a company, he said, is to return a profit to its owners and investors. To do otherwise is theft from the owners. When it came out in the now comparatively more common sense 1970s, it was polarizing. Some shrieked that he was espousing greed is good, which continues to be what the left believes about business and capitalism and smears them with. It's all about greed. But that's not what Friedman was saying. What he was saying is that businesses aren't people. A business is not a sentient being. They don't have feelings. But businesses make profits because they offer a valuable product or service that meets a need in the market. Meeting those needs in itself is a social good, and in doing so, they make profits and return those to investors and shareholders. If they don't, then there's no point in investing. In other words, a business that has no profits isn't sustainable. If the owners want to then spend their profits from the business on what they believe is a social responsibility, donating to causes, assisting others, etc., then they are able to do so because the business earned a profit. But, and this is the key point, if the executives of a business spend money on what they deem to be social responsibility, then they are stealing profits from the owners. In the years after Friedman's essay, Klaus Schwab, that weird little troll who founded and still runs the World Economic Forum, and others developed what eventually became known as stakeholder theory. In this, socialists asserted that executives need to balance interests from everyone directly and indirectly connected to or potentially affected by a business. Owners, customers, the community, including people who don't even buy the company's products, the region, the environment, a government, and so on. Under this theory, as such, executives are entitled to, and let's call it what it is, steal from shareholders and spend money as the executives see fit, rather than give it to the owners, which prevents the owners from spending their profits how they saw fit. Simply put, it would be like a bank which is supposed to give a return of 10% interest, but the bank manager decides to only give you 3% because he wants to spend your money on climate change. Or, if you're on the political left, it would be like he, him, her, they deciding to donate to the National Rifle Association. Shouldn't you decide how to spend what is your money? Speaking of spending money, inflation. Inflation skyrocketed yet again, and that means prices of everything is going up, and that impacts everyone, especially the poor. On today's show, it's exposing and fighting back against woke craziness. I would like to welcome Donna Jackson back to the show. She is the Director of Membership Development for Project 21 at the National Center for Public Policy Research. Donna, it is great to talk to you again.
It's great to be here. Always a pleasure.
So let's start with inflation. Biden's economy and its impacts. CNBC has an article out on Wednesday that said the inflation rose to 9.1% from a year ago, which is astounding. The Fed and other regulators claim they wanted 2% annual inflation, but here we are 4.5 times what their goal is. And as if that wasn't bad enough, CNBC also said that adjusted for inflation, workers' hourly wages fell 1% during the month of June and are down 3.6% from a year ago. So a net loss of almost 13%. So you have a great interview. You gave a great interview to the Daily Caller last week, how Biden's energy policies harm African-Americans. Does the black community think Bidenomics is a good thing at all? I mean, is there anything Biden is doing that is helping black people?
Nothing that he's doing is helping black people. Actually, he's very targeted in making sure he destroys the black community. Mm. They push this Green New Deal agenda so that it increases the cost of living. And if you look at any of the areas where this Green New Deal agenda has been implemented, like California, you see in North Carolina and Chapel Hill, you will see the wealth gap larger between the white and the black community because It increases the cost of living so high that it prices African-Americans out of the market. And so they're actually experiencing not only energy poverty, but they're facing food insecurities. You have Black middle-class people who are now going to food pantries to feed their family because they can't afford to be able to fill up their gas tanks and put food on the table. They are experiencing the largest decrease in their standard of living that they've ever had in their lifetime. And you're talking about 50, 60 years. And so it's so harmful. But this administration decided that Black Americans are disposable. And so they don't care. They push this agenda that we didn't ask for, and they tell us to fall in line and do what we're told.
So are you starting to see any kind of political blowback here? I mean, will the Black community rebel or just continue to vote Democrat because they're told to vote Democrat? Or come November, do you think they'll be as ready to clean house as much as the rest of America seems poised to do?
I'll say this. It's not necessarily that I can tell you how they'll vote, but I can tell you this, that African Americans realize that their goals don't line up with that of the liberal left. And so they're pulling away from this party and this agenda because it's very harmful to their families.
Well, are they realizing that to the point that they would actually vote Republican? Or let me put it this way. What can Republicans do to bring them over to their side?
You know, I'll say this much. The fact that the under President Trump, Black people had the highest employment rate.
Yes.
They had the highest number of new business starts. They had the lowest unemployment rate. They actually had the largest amount of wealth that they've ever had in their families, that they are realizing that they had been lied to all of this time. They realize that the policies that the left has given the Black community were on purpose to keep them subservient and dependent on the government so that only these group of people can stay in power. So, you know, the Biden administration, for the first time, has the lowest approval rate amongst African Americans. And even very hard liberals steeped in the African American community are starting to rebel. You have people from the NAACP, you have people from the National Urban League who have essentially been wings of the liberal left, now reaching out to conservative groups because the people are hurting so bad to the point that there's no help in sight unless they change their thinking.
Well, maybe what it will require is just Republicans reminding the Black community of what they actually had under Trump. And so hopefully they can do that. All right, let's go and take a break. Coming up, more with Donna Jackson, the Director of Membership Development for Project 21. Are Black pastors sabotaging the Black community and being paid off to do it? We'll talk about that next. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Donna Jackson. She's the Director of Membership Development for Project 21 at the National Center for Public Policy Research, one of our favorite organizations, and both of our guests today are from there. And Donna, before we move on to those Black pastors, I want to go back to that Daily Caller interview. Earlier, you had mentioned about targeting Black communities, and you mentioned in that interview, you said, just look at all of the Black cities that have been destroyed. They've been run by Democrats for over 70 years, which, you know, in itself isn't necessarily news to those of us paying attention. You know, we've seen what's happened there with Chicago and Detroit. But what really jumped out at me in that interview was you said they saw what happened and realized that experiment worked, and now they're imposing that on all of Americans. So talk to us more about that.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's not a coincidence that what you're seeing now in terms of the control that they're implementing, the destruction of family units with the implementation of CRT and some of these where they're trying to destroy institutions, they realize that with African-American communities, when they were able to create shortages with food, loss of economic opportunities, where they were able to increase the cost of living and have people in essentially a survival mode, that they could guarantee the vote. Because when you're sitting down there thinking that I'm not going to be able to afford to feed my family, I'm not going to be able to have any kind of financial stability, then your first inkling is to depend on the government.
Right.
And in order to depend on the government, then you're automatically guaranteed that vote. Mm. And so when you have a community who is financially secure, then they think for themselves. But when you have a community that is government dependent and they're full of financial insecurity, then they're going to vote for the politician that says that if you vote for me, I'll give you this subsidy. And so they realize that that worked. And so now they're trying to implement that in all of America. The harmful thing is they're using Black people as an excuse to be able to do it. So they're blackmailing white Americans and calling them racist if you don't go along with the program. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why I speak out so much, because they've created an agenda for Black people that we never asked for. But most Americans don't know we didn't ask for it. And so they tell other Americans, if you don't go along with it, you're a bigot, you're a racist, you're homophobic.
Right, right.
And people get so full of fear that they say, well, I don't want to be called that, or I don't want to be persecuted. And so then they go along with it. This is the worst thing you can ever do.
Oh, yeah.
Because then they have control over your everyday life.
Yep.
They don't care about the destruction that they do to communities.
Yeah,
they only care about the power that they have.
Yes, it's effectively extortion is what they're doing. We will link that interview up on iSpyRadio.com on this week's show page. I highly encourage people to go take a look at that. Moving on to the Black pastors, you know, that was really one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on, is because you believe that Black pastors are sabotaging the Black community and are potentially being paid off to do so. And you're trying to bring some exposure to this. And in the past, we've heard some similar themes like that from Burgess Owens. But talk to us about what you know and what is happening and why.
Well, you know, we could have put an end to this CRT, critical race theory, a long time ago, if Black pastors would have come forward and say, look, the very foundation of faith is redemption, forgiveness and redemption.
Yes, yes.
CRT's number one principle says that racism is normal. It's everywhere, always. And it says that white people, just because of the color of your skin, are born evil and they're irredeemable. That means even salvation in Jesus Christ doesn't work. If you take away the foundation of the church, which is salvation, then the church ceases to exist. And now they're saying that this subjective to there's no objectivity, everything is socially constructed, and all institutions exist to create racism. That means even the church. But the pastors who were so embedded with the liberal left stood by and said nothing, because they were always paid to make sure that they bring those parishioners to the voting booth.
Mm.
You know, on a Sunday morning, the only Christian facility or the only Christian churches that are allowed to have a political message and to tell people who to vote for are Black churches. Why? Because the liberal left controls the pastors, and they know if they control that one figure who has always been prominent in the African-American community, then they have that vote. Every March for Freedom, you're talking about Martin Luther King, you talk about Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass before them, were all inspired by their Christian faith.
Mm.
And so a lot of parishioners don't distinguish the difference between the voice of that pastor and the voice of God.
Mm.
And so they believe when that pastor gets up on the pulpit and says, vote for, you know, Joe Biden, that it's God speaking. And so they go in and vote. But these pastors are afraid that they won't have that money coming in. And so then they continue to do it, even though they see that their parishioners are hurting and the community.
So are you thinking they are being paid off? And if so, who's doing the paying?
Oh, well, I know that a lot of them are paid off. That's not a... I mean, I've recruited some members in like areas like Chicago and some other areas. And they, like I said, they are very, I mean, you're talking about a past president of the NAACP who was a member of the executive board of the national NAACP, was associated with the National Urban League, was part of the Obama Foundation, getting him elected and reelected. I know that they're getting paid because these members are telling me that they're getting paid. The unfortunate thing is that, you know, it's not become about the faith, the Christian values and the principles, because Black people are very spiritual, more than any other group. But it's not about the faith anymore.
No.
It's about the money.
No,
and that's really sad, because you know the very hope that the communities are looking for are in those churches, but those churches are failing the community.
Yeah, that is terribly sad. You know, we've seen the last couple of years that it's as easy to buy off scientists as it is to buy off politicians, And sadly, it looks like that's now happening within our Christian churches as well. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we'll be talking indoctrination via education. Stay with us. Donna Jackson is the Director of Membership Development for Project 21 at the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about them by heading to nationalcenter.org. And then look under the Programs tab at the top of the page. And to make things convenient, we'll have links up to that and more on this week's show page at iSpyRadio.com. So, Donna, in this last segment with you, we want to talk about the indoctrination of our children via our education system across the country, but really zero in on what Black children are being taught. You mentioned earlier that white kids are being told that they're racist and are white supremacists simply because they're white, and their parents are, of course, even worse. So they're being told to internalize that they're guilty, that they're the problems. With Black kids and other minorities, it's a little bit different story. They're being taught an external focus, that they aren't the problem, other people are, and they're just victims. So talk to us about the impact of critical race theory, CRT, on Black children and the problems this is going to cause going forward.
Well, you know, I like to say CRT is the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Yes.
It says that if you are Black, no matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, you will never measure up. So why even try? And so it's worse for Black kids than it is for white kids, because white kids are supposed to focus on, you know, being more conscious of what they're doing. Black kids are told that you're never going to amount to anything. The system is against you. You can't sit down and process any knowledge. That, you know, you see this is systematic in the way they are changing education. All of a sudden, they're getting rid of grading systems. They're getting rid of homework assignments, timetables, deadlines. They're getting rid of standardized tests, honor systems. They're saying that Black people are not capable of sitting down, listening, and following direction. Basically, we're going backwards to a place where it's almost going to be illegal to teach a Black child or a minority even how to read and write and do arithmetic. Even now, math is supposed to be racist. So what does that say to a child when you're a minority? It says you're not capable.
Right.
You don't possess the intelligence, and you never will. And so why even try? So it's actually taken away all the hope from kids that don't know that they couldn't achieve anything until someone told them they can't. It's also teaching the adults or the teachers, well, why are we going to spend resources on individuals like this? Because they can't measure up. And so it's worse for African Americans. In every school where they've implemented CRT, the gap in education has gotten larger. Mm. It hasn't gotten better. It's gotten larger because you've told a child, think about this. This would be child abuse if I told a child every day, you're stupid. You're stupid and you're always going to be stupid. Your father was stupid, your mother is stupid, and you are stupid. And that's basically what you're telling every minority child. You're dumb. You're dumb. You came from a generation of people who are dumb, and you're always going to be dumb. So, you know, it's more harmful to minority kids because it's taken away all the hope. And you've already told them that not only is everyone racist, you said every institution is. So why would I trust the system that I'm in? Because you've already told me the system is racist. You've told me that everyone around me is a racist. You've told me that that racism is normal, is happening every day, everywhere, all the time. And then you've told me that every family is a racist unit sitting down thinking of ways to marginalize me more. So where would the hope come from? Would this individual get inspiration from?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying when you're talking about that, is the hopelessness that just engenders in kids is shocking. It's not just don't try, but why even bother to try in the first place? And, you know, just to kind of maybe tie back into the church there, you know, what kids are being taught today is really the opposite of our Judeo-Christian heritage and the opposite of Christian values. Hate others. They're to blame for your problems. And when instead Christianity teaches that we're all sinners, we should all love one another. And what the left wants is this endless cycle of hate and envy. And last November, you had a great article. It was dealing with CRT, undermining religious faith. And one of the surprising parts to me was when you said this, quote, according to CRT, all of the advances of the civil rights movement were done to perpetuate racism. CRT's undercutting of faith and the King legacy shouldn't be surprising since the founders of CRT were atheists, invested in tearing down our society. But what is shocking, however, is that the movement has found so much acceptance in the churches that are ultimately the targets for repudiation and ultimate destruction. I mean, that is shocking. Why has this taken hold in churches?
You know, I think that what happened is this bitterness and this hatred that was passed down from generation to generation. You know, when I think about forgiveness, when I think about overcome adversity, I think about the children of Israel. And I think about Jews that practice, I mean, every year they remember Passover, but they don't do it to shame the Egyptians. They remember Passover to say what God has brought us from.
That's a great
point.
The
focus is always on God, not on shaming the Egyptians, not on tearing down, you know, pyramids. This should be the same with overcoming and the civil rights movement. It's about what God has brought us from. But when your focus is on the individual and not on God, then you don't have forgiveness.
That's right.
The one thing that I would always tell people is let it go, because it is God that gives us the power to get wealth. It is Him that we look to. And these circumstances happen in order to show us what God is able to do in our lives, not these individuals. We made individuals in this country based upon the race of their skin into gods, where they have the power and we have none. Mm-hmm. I mean, telling a child that you're not responsible for your own success means that that somehow God is unjust, because He still judges us. Yeah. He still rewards us.
Yep.
There's countless examples in the Bible.
You're not just saying that God is unjust, but that He's incapable of helping you as well. Donna, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. This has been fascinating. Absolutely, I enjoyed the discussion. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today with Ethan Peck. He's an associate for the National Center's Free Enterprise Project. The Free Enterprise Project is the conservative movement's only full-service shareholder activism and education program. That means if you own shares in publicly traded companies, you need to get involved with them. Find out more by heading to freeenterpriseproject.org. Ethan, it's great to talk to you today.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so we've talked with other members of the Free Enterprise Project, but you're new to us. I see here on your bio that prior to pursuing a career in political advocacy, you worked as an audio engineer and music producer in New York, as well as a news editor for the Jerusalem Post, and that you hold a master's degree in counterterrorism from the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel. So what led you to the Free Enterprise Project?
Yeah, well, I slowly moved away. I used to be a more of a liberal. And so as I slowly moved away from my former ideology, I seeked out positions in something that would support advocacy in my newfound ideals and values. And so I looked at the National Center, and I thought that the fight at the corporate level was very important because, you know, that's where the money is.
Sure. So in fighting the woke, does what you learned there as far as counterterrorism, does that come into play much?
I would say that, though, I actually haven't thought about that, but I'd say that my degree in counterterrorism was actually corrupted, just like anything. You know, almost every institution nowadays has been corrupted by the woke, and so it was a little bit less in counterterrorism than it was in, you know, other fields, but like English or something. But for sure, the left-wing bias was still there at university in counterterrorism studies. But I do think that fighting, particularly Islamic terrorism, I draw analogies there between the woke and the Islamic terrorists because they oppose the West, so both of them. And
sure.
So I think that learning about Islam actually, even though, you know, the woke, it equipped me with how to fight the woke.
Well,
in a strange way.
I would certainly think that it would really help you see through ideology and fighting that. Your bio also says that you're, quote, well-versed in woke ideology and the social justice mindset, and you're hopeful that traditional American values can be communicated effectively across the aisle. So was there something in particular that woke you up to woke?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was working at the... First of all, when I worked as an audio engineer in New York in music, that's just like, it's a den of, you know, wokeism. It's just purple-haired people everywhere. And personally, I wasn't a happy person being, you know, around this ideology and absorbing it every day. And so when I had moved away and pursued a different career, just being away from that gave me the distance I had the inside knowledge, but then I also was able to step back. And so that distance and that separation gave me the ability to analyze it. And then I really took a deep dive into reading Marx and reading, you know, critical theory and all that kind of stuff. And so before I became a conservative, I really became anti-woke, and that set me on my trajectory. And then I started reading more conservative authors, and that kind of brought me back.
Hmm. So within that bio there, it also mentioned that you're hopeful that traditional American values can be communicated effectively across the aisle. So how can all of us be doing a better job of that, communicating traditional American values?
I think we have to get to the heart of the matter. So we have to go back to basics, and we have to think in a broader way, you know, first principles. So when I speak to people, and this is coming from me, that someone that used to be a liberal, you know, we really... our mainstream culture is liberal. So I wasn't even someone that was politically interested. I just, you know, consumed mainstream culture. And then by default, I became a liberal. Hmm. So if you argue with people on a partisan way, Democrats are like this, Republicans are like this, this candidate, this, it misses the point. I speak to people, I ask them what 2 + 2 equals. You know what I'm saying? Hmm. I go back to, you think men can get pregnant? Just in a very simple way. If you've seen what, you know, Matt Walsh has been doing with his movie, What is a Woman? That's the kind of stuff that I would ask people in my personal conversations over the last couple of years. And it really is a way to make people, you know, snap out of the kind of haze that we've all been put under through public education and just media and social media.
Mm. Okay, you've got a great article up there. It's originally appeared in the Daily Caller. Corporate elites don't recognize shareholders as owners. It discusses not just the disdain that the C-suite, that's the CEOs, CFOs, COOs, and the like, have for shareholders, you know, the actual owners of the company, but also their disdain for capitalism and embrace of a stakeholder theory. And you say this, quote, if corporate bonds are accountable to, if corporate boards are accountable to all parts of society, they are effectively accountable to no one at all. And that's exactly what they want, to dispose mm-hmm. of accountability to shareholders while also taking their money. I think that's exactly right. But this is, you know, when I look at that, it's so endemic to leftist ideology, this disdain for the real owners, much like the disdain leftist politicians have for taxpayers while spending on whatever they want.
Absolutely. You know, I didn't really think of disdain, the word disdain, but, you know, that you're absolutely right. I think there was something that Orwell said. He said that socialists don't love the poor, they just hate the rich. And so I think that's kind of part of it. There's a disdain for a lot of, that's the way that the left operates. And so, and you're right that this stakeholder capitalism is really just a corporate reincarnation of the greater leftist project,
yeah.
which is to confiscate money and power,
yeah.
and push. And,
yeah, you might have earned the money, but it doesn't really belong to you, is how they look at it. It seems.
Yeah.
All right,
exactly.
Let's go and take a break there. We'll have more with Ethan Peck. He has a great article out there. Again, it's Corporate Elites Don't Recognize Shareholders as Owners. We're going to continue talking about that and some of his encounters at shareholder meetings coming up next. Back, we're talking with Ethan Peck. He's with the National Center's Free Enterprise Project. The Free Enterprise Project is out there fighting for you as a shareholder, and you can find out more about them at freeenterpriseproject.org. So, Ethan, in that last segment there, we were talking about your article there, Corporate Elites Don't Recognize Shareholders as Owners. And you described in that article some of your encounters at shareholder meetings, and this one in particular grabbed me. You say, at the meeting of the Lincoln Financial, a corporation large enough to sponsor the Philadelphia Eagles Stadium, I was the only shareholder in attendance at the meeting held specifically for shareholders. I asked then-chairman Bill Cunningham about Lincoln's sponsorship of the Human Rights Campaign, considering its lobbying against Florida's parental rights and education bill. Before he could answer, a corporate secretary jumped in to deflect on his behalf. So this is crazy that you're the only shareholder there. They still managed to try to find a way to dodge your question. But so how did they answer you?
Yeah, it's a riot. Well, so I had first attended the meeting. I drove up to attend the meeting because a lot of these meetings have been virtual. They mm-hmm. use COVID regulations to not. But Lincoln was in person, so I said, I have to go. And so I went there, and they also happened to be a sponsor of the Human Rights Campaign. So for anyone who doesn't know, the Human Rights Campaign is the largest LGBT lobby. And so one of the things that they lobbied against this year very strongly was the parental rights and education bill in Florida. So basically, they're taking shareholder money from Lincoln shareholders and from a lot of shareholders, you know, name a corporation they probably give to HRC. And then they're using that to keep it legal for teachers to speak with five-year-olds about sex and sexuality.
Yeah.
So, and most no shareholders know about this. So I tried to press them. And so I show up to the meeting, and at first they didn't even want to let me in. Right. And this is a meeting for shareholders. That's why it's being held. And wow. So they asked me for proof. And so I gave them proof, and they said, no, that's your organization, not you. Luckily, I had a letter that said that I'm representing my organization. And then I gave it to them, and they still wanted me to like sign this whole affidavit, you know, all this stuff. And then so I get into the meeting finally. And I sign in on the sheet, and I'm the only one there. There are other people there, you know, from the board, employees, from the accounting company, regulators and stuff. But the only one that's just a shareholder is me. And so they have the meeting. It runs for like 4 minutes. the whole entire meeting,
wow.
right?
Wow.
The annual meeting for shareholders, 4 minutes. I finally asked them the question. I say, okay, so then why are you sponsoring HRC, right? Shareholders don't know about this. Do you support speaking to five-year-olds about sex and sexuality? And if not, will you just pull your sponsorship? And the 70, literally, he's the guy was 70, I think 8 or 9 years old, just like Biden. He doesn't answer. And then the secretary comes in and answers for him. And she's not even a board member, right? And I asked the CEO, the chairman, and she basically just gives me like a non-answer and says, you know, we support lots of organizations and they have all kinds of stuff and we don't necessarily support everything from every organization. And that's basically it. She gave me a non-answer, but wow. we'll take a look. That's that kind of thing.
Wow.
And so they don't care. Not only do they not care what shareholders think, which shareholders are the owners of the company, and not only do they not include shareholders in the direction of where the company should go, they actively try to keep shareholders out as best as they can.
Hmm. It is absolutely crazy that's, as you say, they are the actual owners of the company, and yet they're trying to keep them out. I would really encourage people to read that article of yours, and we'll make sure that we link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And within that article, you talk about the larger woke CEOs, but also a lot of the social justice that so many of these companies are pushing. And I look at that combined with some of the other articles that you've had up there and a recent one in the Wall Street Journal as well, talk about ESGs. And so given your background in counterterrorism, do you see a broader coordinated scheme here? I mean, are they imposing woke ideology in these major corporations on purpose in order to weaken American companies rather than focus on maximizing profits and to weaken American culture? Or do they genuinely think customers actually want corporations to be woke?
I think it's a combination. I think that first of all, it's happening on many different fronts. I think it happens inside out, outside in, top down, bottom up, everything. I think that you have employees pushing the woke stuff on the boards. I think in other cases, and the boards capitulating. I think in other cases, you have woke board members, pushing it top down. I think you have outside in influence. You have like left wing activists pushing this stuff. You have media pressuring corporations to be a certain way. And I think that it's all part of the woke's kind of like long march through the institutions. And that, they intentionally overthrew education since, the 50s and the 60s and the 70s,
right.
And intentionally overthrew media and intentionally overthrew government. And I think that corporations were the hardest to crack, but I think that it just took them more time. And so that's why we're seeing it now. But I do think that it's intentional. I think that there are other people that just take advantage of it and kind of ride the wave to scam, shareholders out of the money. And that's kind of what my whole thing was about. There's a lot of communists that say, that Stalin wasn't a real communist. He corrupted Lenin and all this stuff. But the whole point is that it's always going to happen that way, right? Anytime you have communism, it's just going to result in a corrupt government and it's never going to work. And so if these wokesters were sincere in the beginning in turning corporations woke, and it resulted in a bunch of frauds at the top stealing our money, it shouldn't be a surprise.
No. So another great article that you guys have up there on the Free Enterprise Project is one talking about the knee-jerk reactions to the Dobbs ruling, which recently overturned Roe v. Wade, and how this is going to the woke CEOs, this is all going to backfire on them, because immediately they jumped into the fray saying that they're going to pay for employees to travel across state lines to access abortion. Well, in doing so, these woke CEOs means that they have signed up to pay for late-term abortions and even post-birth murder for employees who wait too long to get an abortion in their home states. So I wonder if this is going to set up a huge legal dilemma. And I know that you're not an attorney, but just get you to speculate on this. So you've got a company in Texas. They fly an employee to California or one of these other states for a quote-unquote post-birth abortion, in effect. In other words, infanticide, and that's illegal in Texas and many other states. Does that mean that the CEO could be an accessory to murder in the eyes of Texas?
Well, it's a very, very interesting legal dilemma, and there's a lot to think about there. It makes you think about, the days pre-Civil War in the 1800s, because you're basically having companies intentionally override their own state's laws. Where they currently reside, wherever that office is, And that's gonna, a lot of legal issues are gonna arise from that. How much I trust the, you know, corrupt bureaucracies and legal systems to enforce it the right way, I don't know. But the bigger issue is that I think that basically you have corporations doing what the government, what they think that they can't get. The left is using corporations to do what they can't get through on legislation alone.
Yeah.
And I think that Vivek Ramaswamy, who wrote Woke Inc., I think he has this really interesting concept where he thinks that part of the bailout in 2008, part of the bargain was sort of like, okay, we'll bail you guys out, but then you guys have to do our bidding where we can't do it.
Interesting.
And so it was kind of an agreement. And how conspiratorial you want to get, you know, I don't know. But it's an interesting thing to think about, you know.
Yeah.
They're trying to override the will of the people.
Yeah.
And it's really wild.
Yep, it is. Okay, let's go and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Ethan Peck. He's an associate for the National Center's Free Enterprise Project. Find out more about them by heading to freeenterpriseproject.org.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show. This is the I Spy Radio Show.
And welcome back in our final segment now on the I Spy Radio Show. We're talking with Ethan Peck. He's an associate for the National Center's Free Enterprise Project, the conservative movement's only full-service shareholder activism and education program. Free Enterprise Project buys shares in corporations to combat woke policies and ultimately draw corporations out of politics altogether. Find out more about them by heading to freeenterpriseproject.org. And of course, we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. So, Ethan, in the time that I have left, I'd really love to talk to you about Twitter, because I've just been watching this unfold ever since Elon Musk made his offer to buy them out. I don't know if it was his intention to or not, but he just really cracked open that egg. And it turns out that Twitter lied about the number of fake accounts by huge margins. And not just a few, but millions of these accounts. And this is, as far as I'm concerned, a huge violation of law, or it used to be. This is now being exposed thanks to that offer. And it seems to me that you don't do what Twitter did unless you are convinced that you will never be held accountable. You don't fear regulation. You don't fear the SEC. So you do what you want, including lying to shareholders, investors, and advertisers, which, as I say, used to be illegal. So what are your thoughts about this Twitter deal?
I was skeptical in the beginning of whether or not Musk would actually, you know, follow through with it. And we actually had a proposal at Twitter, which was a proposal addressing their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. And I can get into the proposal process, but I think that it's hopeful that he would buy it. I think that would be great if we can rein in some of the woke board members and have a little bit of a regime change there and some more free speech. And I'm not surprised by the fact that the FTC is sort of willing to play ball with the boards. I think that part of the thing that you have here is sort of there's a revolving door between sort of administrative state and the corporate boards. Hmm. This is why I often refer to board members as corporate bureaucrats, because they're kind of the same. You know, some people leave the SEC to go work at a board and then go back to the SEC and back. It's the same way that you have pharmaceutical board members going to work at the CDC or something, or and back and forth. And so we sort of there's sort of a deep state within corporations. And that's something that I see when I go to these meetings, is that they're all the same, right? These corporations are not necessarily unique to their own company or their own values. I see more similarity from board to board between corporations than I do from board to their own company. And so, you know, I think that Elon Musk is an outsider, and that's why they're so hostile to him. Not that he's some kind of conservative or anything. He's just an outsider. And so, I'm hopeful that he could move it in a better direction, but I doubt his commitment to the anti-woke stuff, because like I said, we had a proposal. And so our proposal was an audit of their DEI policies, which is basically just a corporate name for critical race theory. And we just said, you know, Twitter, you're so proud of your your critical, your diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, can you just audit whether or not this violates non-discrimination law? And so this was our proposal, just that. Just audit your own policy that you're proud of. And so our proposal got 1.6% vote. And so Elon Musk owns 9.2% of the company, so he didn't vote for our proposal. And this is the way it goes down like this many times. So if Elon Musk really was truly out there to fight the woke, I mean, you got to wonder why he didn't vote for our proposal.
Yeah, it is kind of surprising that he wouldn't do that. But to me, what's shocking about this whole Twitter deal is that it exposed that they've been lying for years, apparently, to shareholders, to advertisers, and to the SEC. You've got Parler, Gab, and Getter. These are all privately held companies, but if they were publicly owned and lied about millions of accounts to the SEC and advertisers, I have a real hard time believing that they would just, shrug and not drag them all off to jail to await trial. Do you see evidence of companies treated very differently by regulators when their companies known to be conservative versus ones that are clearly woke?
Right. I'm not really sure what companies are conservative, but I can tell you that the SEC, basically how the shareholder proposals process works is, if you own over $2,000 worth of shares in a company for at least 3 years, any shareholder that owns that much can propose a policy change or whatever, what have you. And then what happens usually is the board will just come back and say, we're not including this proposal on the ballot next year. And then the SEC will have to approve whether or not they're letting the company do that, because you're not allowed to just leave it off. And so, we'll just, say, hey, SEC, they're not going to let us put this proposal on. And the SEC will usually just play ball with them.
Well, I'm just shocked that the SEC is going along with Twitter effectively bilking millions of dollars out of their advertisers and not weighing in at all on that. Right. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Ethan, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been fun.
Thanks a lot.
Lots of great information for you on this week's show page, links to our guest organizations and articles, and one from the Wall Street Journal, The Many Reasons ESG is a Loser. ESG is environmental, social, and governance, the means to impose leftist ideology on corporate boards, which forces you as a customer or shareholder to be an indirect supporter and funder of the left. Add to this that funds like BlackRock charge investors 5 to 15 times as much in fees for ESG companies, which underperform. Only in leftist thinking does it compute to pay more for fewer profits in exchange for wholly imaginary benefits. Be smart, wake up about woke, and don't be silent, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.